I believe that was the shortest introduction I've ever had. Don. Yes. Thank you. Please, stop. Wayne, you're embarrassing. Please. Hey, come on. You're killing me here.
Don, when you get to be Wayne's age, just get your name right.
There you go. I have to live there for the next day. I'm not going to comment on that if that's okay. It's so good to see you all tonight. Thank you for being here on this Saturday night. We appreciate that so very, very much. This has been a busy time for you, I know. Most all of you were here last night, and we had a wonderful crowd this morning for Saturday morning. Thank you so much. It says something about you and what you are concerned about and what you value. So thank you, and thank you for being here tonight. If you are visiting with this church family, as Tommy and I are this weekend, we especially welcome you. Thank you for being here and for the encouragement that you give us by virtue of your presence here. And thank you to this congregation for making Tommy and me both feel so very welcome among you. You are so very gracious and hospitable. You've been so very kind to us, and for that, we are very, very grateful. What a wonderful lesson we just heard about a son who did not appreciate what his father provided. And in this period, we want to look at the other side of that equation, talk about moms and dads and about grandmothers and grandfathers and that pivotal role that we play in the lives of those children that we are trying to raise to come to know and honor God. Just a few weeks ago in the Tampa Bay Times newspaper where Tommy and I lived, there was a story that came out of upstate New York. It's a story of a mom who had a 16-year-old son, and for the second time, she was going to traffic court with her 16-year-old son. Now, he's only 16 years old, so he hasn't been driving very long. And so for the second time she's going to traffic court, she is not happy about that at all, because that means, again, time away from work, you've got to fight the traffic, you've got to get there, it takes a whole day. And so there she is with her 16-year-old son. Finally, it is their time to stand before the judge, and so there they are. Well, the judge, fairly quickly after he begins to talk to them, realizes this is a good family. This is a good mom. This is a good boy. And so he decides that he will be gracious to this boy. And so he says, son, I'm only going to level a fine of $55, which was just almost nothing in comparison to what it could have been. But even at that, his mother looked over at him with absolute disgust. And she took her hand and she went, bam, and slapped him on the back of the head. Well, the judge was a little taken aback by that. I mean, he doesn't see that every day in his courtroom, but he eventually smiled and he said, ma'am, I believe that calls for a $10 reduction in the fine. And the mom looked at him and said, that's great, because by the time we get home, you're going to owe me money. Parenting is without question the ultimate adventure. And it is, because children don't ask to be born in this world. We make that choice for them. We make that decision. And when we make that decision, we have brought responsibility to ourselves in that. That task is frightening. It is a frightening task as you contemplate the monumental nature of the task and the consequences of failure. And yet, by the same token, the task is exciting as you contemplate the joy of seeing a child grow to become an adult that is well-adjusted and capable and responsible, and in particular, if that child is serving the Lord. I think moms and dads and grandparents are more serious about the challenges of parenting and grandparenting than perhaps any time in the past. Now, there could be a lot of reasons for that. There are multiple books that are available and magazines and television shows, all in countless numbers that are available to try to address this very vital subject. And two, I think we have probably all been impressed with some examples of parental failure and the consequences of that. I read a little thing a while back that said most little girls grow up and they marry someone who reminds them of their dad, which is why most moms cry at weddings. Well, I hope that's not the case. But I mean, let's be honest about this. There are no perfect parents. There are no perfect parents. Now, I'll grant you that some are much better than others, but none, of course, are perfect. Virtually all parents wish that at some point in time we could have a parental mulligan, if we could just have a do-over. There are words that we would like to take back. There are decisions that we made that we would like to reconsider and rethink, and yet we don't get the opportunity to do that. And so it's imperative that we do our very best with every opportunity that does, in fact, come our way. It's interesting that in Deuteronomy 6, in that series of speeches that Moses makes to his children, the children of Israel, that he gathers them in Deuteronomy 6, and he talks to them about the family and about the home, and he talks about moms and dads, and he talks about grandparents. And the statement that he makes is this. He said, "These commandments that I give you today, impress them on your children." Impress is an interesting word. We understand that. To make an impression, to leave an impression. And so he says, look, the words that I'm saying to you today, I want you to forge them into your children and grandchildren, to live and teach these words in such a way that it will leave an impression upon them. Now that's going to take effort. That will take a plan. And so in this passage, in Deuteronomy 6, he says, here's what you do. You infuse every aspect of your child and grandchild's life in the concept of God. And so he says, when you sit in your house, that is, in the mundane, ordinary affairs of life, you infuse the concept of God. And he said, when you walk by the way, the earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof, the world, and all that in them is. Teach that to your kids. And he said, when they lie down at night, maybe you could teach them to say with the psalmist, "I laid me down and I slept because my God was with me." And when you rise up in the morning, Moses said, and so teach them to say again with David, "This is the day the Lord has made, and so I will rejoice and I will be glad in it." And the implication, of course, is that this is a daily. This is not merely a Sabbath activity, but this is a daily activity, and it's imperative because this is mom and dad and the kids. We hear a lot about that in America, that is a traditional family. Let me tell you tonight that mom, dad, and the kids is not a traditional family, ladies and gentlemen. It is a biblical family. It's the way God designed that to be. Do you have a Bible tonight? Psalm 127, please. 127th Psalm. You're a good Bible student, so you know what we are about to read. And I want to read just a little bit of this particular passage, Psalm 127, and beginning in verse 3. Now, the passage is prefaced with the words of verse 1, that unless the Lord build the house, they labor in vain who build it. And we certainly understand that. Here's the application for a family, beginning in verse 3. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. They are like arrows in the hands of a warrior. So are the children of one youth. And so happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. Let's stop right there for just a second. I would imagine that every grandparent at some point in time has seen their child, their son or daughter, who is grappling, trying to get a grip on a toddler who is challenging them, and that grandparent has looked at their child and said, "You know what? You're being paid back. You're being paid back for what you did to me." But this passage reminds us that children are not punishment. Children are a reward from God. In fact, here's the way that he said that. They are like arrows in the hands of a warrior. So are children of one's youth. Children are like arrows in the hands of a warrior. I thought about calling this lesson tonight, "How to Shoot Your Kids." But then I thought that probably not politically correct. But what I do want to do tonight is think about that concept. I want to think about what that image is trying to say to moms and dads and to grandmothers and grandfathers. See, we talk all the times about mom and dad, but we often don't mention grandparents in this. And I think it's applicable to both. So, what's the image trying to say to moms and dads and grandmothers and grandfathers, like arrows in the hands of a warrior? Let me suggest two or three things real quickly tonight, and then the lesson's yours. Here they are. Number one, I think it suggests, first of all, that we have to commit to the process. That when we decide to have a child, that we have to commit to that process from that day forward. Law enforcement officers that I've spoken to and soldiers that I have talked to all say the same thing. That you don't draw your weapon unless you are committed to following through. You don't draw your weapon unless you are committed to a process. Well, why does that matter to parents and to grandparents? Well, because obviously good, godly parents don't automatically have good, godly kids. I know that's true because I read it in the early days of the Bible. So on page 2 of your Bible, God has 2 kids. They're named Adam and Eve. He puts them in a perfect environment. He is a perfect father to them. And both of those kids rebel against their dad. And then you turn to page 4 of your Bible. And Adam and Eve get straightened out, and they have 2 kids, Cain and Abel. And Cain and Abel are put in an environment where there is no internet, they have no cell phones, they have no negative peer pressure of any kind, and yet one of those kids rises up and kills the other. And so it's imperative then, isn't it, that if God Almighty had a problem with His two children, we may, well, have children with difficulty with ours as well. And so we got to think about that process and commit ourselves to that process. So, good parents, godly parents, don't automatically have good or godly kids. Now, let me quickly add to that. Sometimes parents do contribute to their children's demise in a very powerful, negative kind of way. And so there is a statement made about David in regard to his parenting of a boy, a child of his, named Adonijah. And the text said that David had not at any time rebuked him by saying, "Why have you done so?" David never said to his boy, "Don't do that. That's wrong. It's out of bounds. Why have you done that? This is a teachable moment." David didn't do that. He wasn't involved in his children's life, hence the dysfunction in his family. But it's a parent's job to be involved in our children's life, and a grandparent's job to be involved in those grandchildren's life to the extent that we can. I think all of that implies that moms and dads know something about the process, that they're not just winging it, trying to figure it out every morning when they wake up, but there's a plan, there's a strategy in place, because like arrows in the hands of a warrior, so are children, children of our youth. Soldiers plan, and plan meticulously for what they're about to do. Do you remember a few years ago when SEAL Team 6 invaded the compound where Osama bin Laden had been hiding? You know what was interesting about that? I saw a documentary about that a few months later. And what was interesting is that they had discovered his compound and believed that he was there a good while before they invaded. And so they didn't just find it and then just sporadically act. They built in the desert a compound using the satellite imagery. They built an exact replica of the compound. And they practiced over and over and over that invasion. And so you remember in that invasion that there was a Black Hawk helicopter that went down. It was not able to fly to take people out. And so they destroyed it. Well, it wasn't an accident that they had the explosives there to destroy that helicopter so the information wouldn't fall in enemy's hands. And it was no accident that there was another Black Hawk out there circling, hovering, waiting in case something happened that was able to swoop in and extricate those soldiers from that scenario. None of that was by accident or chance. They had rehearsed that over and over again. They had thought through the process repeatedly, and that, ladies and gentlemen, is the point. Parents need to do the same. There are just countless resources that are available now to help us in our role of raising children. Go into any Bible bookstore, and you'll find, and you can very quickly cull through what is valuable and what is not. It's not a difficult process at all. But the point of it is that we have to commit to that process, and we need to have a plan in place. Now, having said that, secondly, that means that we've got to provide the direction. That's what having a plan is about. Like arrows in the hands of a warrior, we've got to provide some direction. With an arrow, you have to aim. You provide the direction that you want it to go. Let's be perfectly clear about that tonight. His parents and his grandparents. If we don't provide the direction for our children and our grandchildren, the world will be more than happy to provide it for them. It's why the Bible says in Proverbs 19, the beginning of verse 18, "Discipline your child, for in that there is hope. Do not be a willing party to their death." There's an awful lot in that verse, isn't there? Discipline your child. When we hear that to an American ear, when we hear discipline, we immediately think of corrective. But you know, because again, you're good Bible students, at the front end of that is disciple your child. Teach, instruct, train your child. And so train, instruct, teach your child. Because in that, you are giving them hope. And if you don't do that, notice the implication, you then have become a willing party to their spiritual death. What a terrible thing to be a part of. What that is saying, ladies and gentlemen, is that the most important variable in your child or grandchild's life is you. You are the first influence that they are going to have. When I was a boy growing up in California, I remember going into a home, and there was a plaque on the wall that said, "Children learn what they see." And then it had a long list of things. I don't remember what the points in that were, what was on the plaque. But that phrase has always stayed with me, that children learn what they see. And I believe there's truth in that. And so I think if children and grandchildren see that we value excellence, that we don't cut corners and we don't take shortcuts, I think chances are pretty good that they will value excellence as well. If our children and grandchildren see that we work hard to achieve, that we are self-disciplined, that we are industrious, that we don't quit when the going gets tough, chances are pretty good that they will work hard to achieve as well. If our children and grandchildren see that we are honest, that we do not lie, we do not deceive, that even as the psalmists say, we are willing to swear to our own hurt and change not, if they see that, chances are pretty good that they will be honest as well. And if our children see that we value the spiritual dimension in our lives, the chances are pretty good that they will value the spiritual dimension in their lives as well. It doesn't guarantee that because they are individuals. They have free moral choice just like you and I do. But the chances are pretty good that they will value that. And so I will tell you that committing to the process and providing that direction then becomes imperative, particularly given the culture in which we live in 21st century America. USA Today, not very long ago, had an article by the title, Young Adults Are Less and Less Devoted to Their Faith. And here's how it read. Most young adults today don't pray. They don't worship. They don't read the Bible. A major survey recently concluded. If the trends continue, the millennial generation will see churches closing quickly, said Tom Rayner, president of Lifeway Christian Resources. And the article went on to say, in the group survey of 12,000 12 to 29-year-olds, 72% say they are really more spiritual than religious. We talked about that this morning. That the fastest growing segment of religious identification in America in 2018 is spiritual, but not religious. Well, what does that mean? Well, it means that there is a generation of young people that in essence say, look, I love God. That's not open for discussion. I love God, but I don't pray, I don't worship, I don't read the Bible. Well, the question then is, what are you worshiping? Well, in many ways, they are worshiping a God that they have manufactured. And in many ways, they are worshiping themselves. Now, here's the point of that. The point is that the odds in so many ways today are stacked against parents and grandparents in the raising of their children to know and love and serve and honor God. That means, I believe, that we need more parents and grandparents who are very much like Joshua in Joshua 24. You remember that story that Joshua gathers again the people and he recounts the history, what God has done for the nation, what God has done for him. And then, of course, he makes that famous statement that is, for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And I would just suggest that moms and dads and grandmothers and grandfathers make a decision about that every single day. That every day as we have opportunity to interact with children and grandchildren, we make a decision about whether or not that day, whether anybody else in the world does or not, but for that day with our children and grandchildren, we're going to serve the Lord. And we're going to teach them to do that. I will tell you, I think one of the most beneficial ways that we can do that is to, with our kids and grandkids, to focus more on G-O-D than GPA or MVP. I want you to think about that with me. That one of the best ways we can do that is to focus more on G-O-D than GPA or MVP. So let me ask you a couple of questions tonight. Would you rather that your child or grandchild be known as the most brilliant scholar on his high school or college campus, or the most committed Christian on campus? Or would you prefer that your child be known as the most gifted athlete on his high school or college campus, or as the most committed Christian on campus? Now, granted, I know that what most people, I think, would answer that and say, well, we'd like to have both. And sometimes you do get both. I understand that. Sometimes you do get both. A few years ago, I was in Columbia, Missouri, in a gospel meeting on Sunday morning. The opening prayer, there was a young man who strode to the microphone, and we bowed to pray. And I will tell you, this young man prayed a prayer. It was deep, and it was spiritual, and it was reverent to God, and it was full of gratitude and praise to God. It was a wonderful petition to the Father. And I thought to myself as I was praying with him, I thought, I want to go meet that young man afterwards, and I want to commend him on the way that he speaks to God. So after the service was over, I asked. I said, where's the young man that led the opening prayer? And they pointed me to him, and they said, do you know who that is? And I said, I have no idea. And they said, well, he's a starting quarterback for the University of Missouri. And so sometimes you can get both. Now, what we typically say as parents and grandparents about that is that, well, there has to be a balance. You know, there needs to be a balance between God and between academics and between athletics and between music. And I understand that. But oftentimes, is it not true? Is it not oftentimes true that the spiritual side of that equation gets shorted a little bit? And could it be, is it not true that oftentimes we talk to our kids and our grandkids much more about their grades and about their athletics and about music than we do about God? Now, don't misunderstand me tonight. Don't misquote me here for a moment, please. I realize that grades and athletics and music are very important to the experience of growing up. I understand that. But I also know that in the last 30 years, ladies and gentlemen, not a single human being has asked me what my GPA was in college. And in the last 30 years, nobody's asked me if I enjoyed playing basketball in high school, which I very, very much did. And nobody's asked me in the last 30 years if I enjoyed playing trombone in the band, which I very, very much did not. But nobody's asked me about that. My dad had all kinds of Joshua 24 moments. My dad was a stickler about grades. I will tell you, he was a stickler about academics. And if you did not do what he believed that you were capable of doing, there was a conversation to be had. And about athletics and about the band, my dad's philosophy was, that's fine, enjoy yourself, knock yourself out. But once you make a commitment to that, you do not quit. It doesn't matter if you like it or not. It doesn't matter if it's difficult or not. If you made a commitment, then you absolutely will see it through and you will not quit. But I will tell you, more than any of that, he was a stickler for God. In the 18 years that I lived at home, never one time, not once do I ever remember the question being asked, are we going to church today? It just wasn't open for discussion in our house. The one thing that I knew about my mom and dad was that the spiritual side of life was the most important thing to them. And I know that when I say that, I can almost hear some individuals saying, but you know what, Don? You know what about that? I just don't think that I really ought to be forcing religion on my child. I really believe that ultimately that they should be free to make up their own minds about that. I mean, really? At 12 or 14 or 16, do we really believe that? I mean, does that work with anything else? And so you're at home one day and the high school counselor calls and says, look, we've been looking at your child's attendance record and our calculation is that your child has been missing about 50% of the time from school. I mean, is your response going to be, well, you know what? We have decided that you just can't force education on a child now. And we've decided they're going to have to make up their own mind about education. And so we've decided we're just going to leave that up to them. Well, nobody's going to do that. Can you imagine coming to worship on a Sunday morning and somebody that you love, somebody who's a true and genuine friend to you, comes up to you and says, look, I was just in the restroom. And I got to tell you, I smelled both smoke and alcohol on your teenage child. I mean, is your response going to be to that? Yes, I know. Wouldn't be our choice. But we've decided that you can't choose for them forever. And so we've just decided she's got to make up her own mind about those kinds of things. Well, nobody's going to do that. Because again, we know the Bible says, look, you've got to discipline and teach and train your child and provide the direction, because if you do, you're giving them hope. And if you do not, then you have become a willing party to their spiritual death. And so we've got to commit to the process and provide the direction. And then thirdly, that would mean that we've got to aim for the target. It's not just providing direction, it's aiming toward a target that is worthy of being hit. We've got to make sure that our kids and grandkids have what they need to make progress in the direction that we want them to go. Now, you know that the quintessential example of that, of course, would be Jesus. And so we have this summary statement in Luke 2 and beginning in verse 52, that Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. And I think, is that not the precise pattern of growth and development that we all would like to engender in our children and in our grandchildren? We'd all like to help them hit that mark. I mean, we want our kids and grandkids to increase intellectually. And so that begins in many ways in the crib. As we talk to them and we put those mobiles there and we try to begin to teach and to train, and that goes on in their young years and through their high school, and we provide an education for them and help them get that in college. And what we really want is them to be lifelong learners. And so we want them to increase intellectually and also physically. We want them to grow and to develop. And so those of you who have that very small children, I would imagine we could probably go in some homes here, and probably there's a doorway, and there may be some hash marks there where you line those kids up, and you mark, and you know what the date is, and we like to see that progress is being made until finally the child physically outgrows the parent. And that's not something that we complain about. We're happy that they've grown and made progress physically, and we want them to increase like Jesus socially. No parent, no grandparent wants a child or a grandchild to have difficulties with socialization. And so there are Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts and Cub Scouts, and there are play groups, and there are church settings, and there's school activities, and all those things that help a child to develop socially. But especially, of course, we want our children and grandchildren to develop spiritually in favor with God. We want to be able to replicate that. And so Paul would write to his young protege, Timothy, and he says, Timothy, I'm proud of the faith that you have. I remember the genuine faith that is in you. Well, that's to be appreciated and applauded. But he said, Timothy, don't ever forget that the reason that that seed of faith was able to germinate in your life is because it was planted there by a mom and a grandmother who loved you and cared about you enough to commit to the process and provide the direction and aim for a target that was worth hitting. Now, moms and dads and grandparents, could I just suggest that the key element to making that happen is time. It takes time. And we fool ourselves if we believe that we can raise children who are intellectually and physically and socially and spiritually strong if we're not committing time to that process. It's why the Bible says that a child left to himself brings his mother, brings his father, brings his parents shame. It takes time. You realize that 100 years ago in the United States, a century ago in the United States, parents spent 54% of their waking hours with their children. 100 years ago, parents spent 54% of their waking hours with their kids. Today, it is somewhere around 15 to 18%. Now, what's the difference? Well, there's a huge difference. Because 100 years ago, how did most people make their living? Well, they were farmers. We lived in an agrarian society. And so kids would get up in the morning before they went to school, and they would work with mom and dad. And when they got home, they would work with mom and dad. And so it's a different world. We need to acknowledge that. We should not be naive about that. But think about even that. Let's suppose, ladies and gentlemen, that you sleep 7 or 8 hours a night and you work 8 to 10 hours a day. Well, that still leaves you with 6 to 9 hours of time per day. And I would say to you that if you have small children at home, they deserve the lion's share of that. Now, the question, of course, is how do we do that? How do we organize our life in such a way that we are giving them the time that they need? Well, I think there are two or three things that can help with that. One is to learn to go home. To learn to go home. And I mean by that at the end of the workday, go home. Instead of going somewhere else, go home. Be home. Let me say to the men in this audience, by the way, who have children at home, when you go home and you pull into that driveway, you pull into the garage, and you turn off that automobile, don't just bound out of the car. I would encourage you to sit there for a second. And remember, gentlemen, that nothing bad that happened to you at work that day is the fault of anybody inside that house. And to go inside the house and take out a bad day on those who are inside who had nothing to do with that is wrong. But when your work day is over, go home. Go home. And when you're home, try to be home to the best of your ability. I heard a story years ago about a dad who every night he brought home a briefcase full of work, And he had a seven-year-old boy. And his seven-year-old boy, of course, wanted his dad's time. He wanted to be with his dad. But dad was working every night. And so his little boy, his little seven-year-old, asked him one night. He said, "Dad, why do you do that? Why do you bring all that work home every night?" And his dad said, "Well, son," he said, I just can't get everything done at work during the day that I need to get done." And his little boy looked at him and said, "Well, Dad, can't they put you in a slower group?" Well, maybe that would be good for us sometimes to just be in a slower group and so learn to go home. And then secondly, refuse to allow others to set your schedule. Don't let other people set your schedule. You take ownership of that. You set your priorities and don't let someone else set them for you. Be as diligent about guarding your time at home as you are your time at work. Everybody's had the experience of somebody saying, "Hey, look, would you like to go and do A, B, and C with us?" And we've all had to answer at that at times and say, "You know what, I'd love to do that, but I can't. I've got to work that day, or I've got to work that night." What are we doing? We're putting boundaries around our work. We're saying nothing can interfere with that. We need to do that with our family. We need to draw some boundaries around our family as well. And then thirdly, we've got to stay focused on our kids and our grandkids. We've got to stay focused on our children, on our grandchildren. We've all had the experience of talking to somebody and they're standing right there. They may be 3 feet away from us. We're talking to them. You could reach out and touch them. And yet it dawns on us while we're talking to them, they're not there. They're a million miles away. They're physically right there, but they may as well not be because they're not paying any attention at all. You know what? Our kids and grandkids know that about us as well. They know when we're in tune with them and when we are not. And so let me say again, there is nothing that you will watch on SportsCenter. There is nothing online. There is nothing in the paper. There is nothing that you are doing like that is more important than the interaction with your children. And so we've got to make sure, ladies and gentlemen, that we give them time as we're aiming for the target and providing that direction as we've committed to the process. And one other quick thing before I leave this, and we won't say much about this, but as we do that, we need to be reminded of Proverbs 22:6. "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he'll not depart from it." It's why we have to commit to the process and provide the direction and aim for that target. Let me say a word about that verse, because I don't know that there's been any verse that's been more misused than that one. That verse is not exclusively referring to spiritual and moral direction. And by that I mean, that verse is not a blanket promise that if you teach your kids the right values of life, that they will never stray from those right values spiritually. If you've ever thought that verse teaches that, you need to disabuse your mind of that, because that's just not true. Experience and the Bible both teach differently. The Bible teaches that interpretation is not true, that if you raise your kids spiritually, they will never depart spiritually from the faith. The Bible teaches that is not true. God taught that in Ezekiel chapter 18. In Ezekiel 18, God told a story where He chronicled three generations in one family. And the first generation, the first man, He said, "This man is a good, good man." And God's conclusion about him is, "He shall surely live, saith the Lord." That's not Don Truex saying that. That's God saying that. This is a good man. But that man had a son. And Ezekiel 18 says that son saw every righteous thing that his father did and determined that he would do the opposite, and every unrighteous thing that his father avoided, he determined that he would do. And at the end of that man's life, God said, the Lord says, "He shall surely die. He will not live for the righteousness of his father." And so here was a good man that had a bad son. Some of my brethren sometimes say that can't happen. A good man can't have a bad son. God says, yes, it can. Sometimes we have poured undue guilt on people because we've never thought through a passage like this. Several years ago, I heard Brother Sewell Hall preach about Proverbs 22:6, and he said, "You know, the Hebrew in that passage, the way you should go," he said, "really," he said, "perhaps a much better translation would be, train a child according to his individual bent, for that bent will always be a part of his life." It seems to me that That's correct. And Solomon is encouraging moms and dads and grandmothers and grandfathers to recognize their child and grandchild's unique emotional, physical, intellectual, and spiritual tendencies and train them accordingly. If you have more than one child, what do we always say? They're different. They're just different. My two kids are different as night and day. The only way you can do that, the only way that you can come to understand that, know that about your children and grandchildren, and the only way that you can train them according to their individual bent so that they reach the target that we want them to reach is to give time. There is no substitute for that. And then finally tonight, we'll finish with this. There does come a point in time that we have to release them with love. That is the hardest thing. I think in many ways, it's a parent's most difficult task. To understand, I think God in essence says, look, I'm giving you these kids for about 18 years. Do your best, prepare them for life, and then you have to open your hand and let them go. Where does the Bible say that? Well, it's in the book of Truex, chapter 2, verse 1. But it seems to me that's what God is saying. Look, I'm giving you these kids. And you commit to the process when you decide to have a child. Because you made that decision. They did not. I heard Ed Harrell preach one night, and he was talking about his daughter that was having an argument with him when she was a teenager, and it wasn't going the direction she wanted at all. And finally, in her exasperation, she put her hands on her hip and she said, I tell you what, Dad, I did not ask to be born in this family. And he looked at her and said, that's exactly right. If you had asked, we would have said no. Well, but the fact is, they didn't ask. And so we made that decision. And so we committed to that process. And so we got to provide the direction, aim for the target, so that one day we can release them with love. It doesn't mean that we don't love them anymore. You never stop being a parent. Once you get on that train, you never get off. And if you try to get off, shame on you. It doesn't mean that you don't love them. If my kids are now 34 and 38. It's unbelievable to me. But I pray for them every morning. I have a certain situation every morning that reminds me to pray for Heather and Josh and John and Katie, their mates, and Jocelyn and Keller, my two grandchildren, every morning of this world. There are no perfect families. Not my family, not your family, not any family, because every family is composed of fallible human beings. And so every family inevitably has challenges and difficulties. But every family also has the responsibility to do and be their very best. And so every parent, every grandparent needs to thank God every single day for the opportunity to be the parents and grandparents of those kids. And parents and grandparents need to promise God every day that we promise you, God, that we will do our very best for them today. Whatever anybody else does, as for me and my house today, God, we're going to serve you. Let me give you tonight three things to take home. Let me give you three things, just practical things to take home very quickly tonight. Number one, fight for your family. Fight for your family. Why? Because no one else will. Not the school, not the government, not the media. You'll have to do that. Fight for your family. Number two, model respect for authority. Why? Because no one else will. When Paul said, look, we've got to respect authority, Romans 13 and 1, because authority has been ordained by God. Respect for authority is the key, ultimately, to spiritual obedience. And so if you want your children and grandchildren to obey the Lord later, you've got to teach them to respect authority now. The authority of parents and grandparents and teachers and church leaders and policemen and all those who are in positions of authority. You've got to model respect for them because nobody else will. And third, value character over performance. Why? Because no one else will. Listen to me carefully, ladies and gentlemen. Every other place in this world is going to tell your children and grandchildren that their value as individuals is determined by either their GPA or the number of points that they can score or how they look in the mirror or how much money they have in their pocket. And we've got to be the ones to help them realize that they are of value simply because they have been made in the image of God. And think about that. What good is it if our children and grandchildren are star athletes, if they play on every traveling team known to man, but then lose their soul? What good is it if they carry a 4.0 average and go to an Ivy League school, but then lose their soul? What good is it if they have an amazing career and make more money than they can spend, but then they lose their soul? And so we've got to value character over performance. And somebody says, oh, but Don, it's just so hard. I mean, the world is just so bad. It is just so hard to raise good kids in an evil world. Well, that's right. But you realize, ladies and gentlemen, the world has never been a safe place to live. Never. It wasn't in Adam's day. It wasn't in Noah's day. It wasn't in Moses' day. It wasn't in David's day. It wasn't in Jesus' day. And it's not in our day as well. But you can do this. You can do this. With God's Word as your guide. With God's people as your help. With the good mind and abilities that God has given you. You can do this. Raising children is not easy. I will grant you that. Raising children is not easy. If it was, it would not begin with a process called labor. That probably should clue us in. This is going to be work. It's going to be laborious. It's going to be exhausting. It's going to be expensive. But while it is the hardest thing that we will ever do, it is the most rewarding and valuable thing that we will ever do either. Because you're shaping hope for the next generation. You're providing the church future servants and future leaders. And the key to that is you. It's moms and dads and grandmothers and grandparents, grandfathers. That's God's plan A, and He has no plan B. You're the key. And God's counting on you. And you can do it. For the benefit of your kids and to the glory of God. You can do that. You can do that. But it begins not with physical kids. It begins by being a child of God. That's where it begins. That masterful lesson that Tommy taught us so beautifully illustrates at the end when the Father says, you are not going to be a slave. Absolutely not. It's interesting when He says all those things and He gives him the family ring with the family crest, no doubt, and the shoes of sonship and the robe to indicate that this is a member of the family. It's very much like when Paul wrote to the Galatians and he said, you know what? You are not slaves at all. You have been adopted into God's family. It's almost as if God looks down and says, stand up. You're not a slave. You're my son. You're my daughter. That's where it begins. And maybe that's you tonight. Maybe you came in this building tonight and you know that the next step that you need to make in your journey of faith is to be baptized into Christ or to come home to Him. To do exactly what that parable represents. Come home to your Father. If that's you tonight, then there's a response to God that you need to make in a public way and we can help you. Please listen. Let's stand. Let's sing.